Welcome, everyone. This is the last talk in the theme, Suffering and Its Cause, the desire, Suffering and Its Cause. And tonight's talk is Desire for Non-Existence. And just to bring you into the fold of this talk, we have been looking at the ways that we create an enormous amount of contraction and anxiety in ourselves, and how we hold the pain of our lifetime as we chase after a world or wish from the world certain things that it can never give us. And I was struck by an article in the Tricycle magazine, I believe, on something like the culture of comfort. It's a really good article, and I really suggest you do it, but it really sobered me up in a way that helped me deeply understand how the whole culture has presented a kind almost a transfixed towards holding a kind of comfort level that we really refuse to relinquish, and how we will do anything to maintain and establish and continue that comfort level to the point of fighting other cultures that seem to be taking or wanting to deprive us of the resources for that comfort. And so to get a sense of how this need for comfort dominates our life and how addicted we are to maintaining a certain quality of life so that that comfort level can be sustained. And then we move to a different way that we attempt to maintain our influence upon life, and that is the desire for existence that we spoke about a couple of weeks ago. The desire to create, to nurture, to breathe life, to invest life with existence that it doesn't inherently have. And to do so, we have to single something out, to focus in on it, and to add an ingredient to it that it doesn't contain, which is a separation, a need for it. And this need for existence, this need to have life for our beck and call, and to invest almost Frankensteinishly into a world that doesn't have inherent life in its separate forms, to invest in that, to make it rise from the dead, so to speak, so that it can serve us in ways that we want it to serve. And, of course, that also includes the desire for existence in us, and the desire for existence in me, for the me and the egoic sense of me to maintain itself and to continue is part of that whole inscription of that second desire, that form that desire takes that the Buddha had been talking about. He talked about the desire for pleasure. He talked about the desire for existence. And thirdly, tonight, we're going to talk about the desire for non-existence. That seems a little paradoxical and perhaps confusing, that you could have both the desire for existence and the desire, sometimes simultaneously, for non-existence. So we have to get a sense of what this non-existence, desire for non-existence, means. And it doesn't take a great deal of awareness to be also focused on the fact that we want to divest life of existence as often as we want to invest it with existence. We don't want it in our world. We don't want it to be a part of our environment that we live within. And so we try to establish a kind of negation process to life, a way that we can refute it, we can push it away and keep it away from us through fear and aversion and other forms. It's also a desire to destroy to get rid of, to kill, to exterminate. It contains perhaps the seeds of some of the causes of war and brutality that our minds can easily produce. So we need to understand this desire for non-existence, both as it manifests externally in the world around us, as we don't want things to occur that do, and also in ourselves, this way that we from time to time feel about ourselves and want to divest ourselves from existence, wanting just simply to die, wanting a part of us, if not the whole of us, to terminate, to leave, to end, to stop the burden. So part of this, I think, has a psychological component, as most of these Dharma talks do. Part of it is a spiritual component. And so we have to look at both of those to understand them fully so that we can get a sense of how this desire really plays forth in our life, both on the psychological and spiritual level. Fundamentally, things don't exist by themselves. I hope we get a sense of that as we go through these talks, and that individual existence is mind-created. And so investing in something to make it alive and divesting in something to take that aliveness from it is entirely a mental creation over and above the life that is always here. There is aliveness, but it isn't individually determined. It's not specific to a thing. You can't separate a thing out from it and say that exists and this doesn't. Existence is, and it has to be abided within. It can't be determined and sliced and cut off. And that is really the spiritual journey that we are undertaking. And so to know how it is that we constantly try to maintain a kind of control over the life of something and over the death of something is a very interesting part of our need to maintain our own existence. And so we're going to look at that topic, and I think this topic leads to a great deal of inward focus that is truly a journey of the urban Buddhist. And I'm getting more and more focused as I'm beginning to pull together my ideas in writing a book on the urban Buddhist, what the urban Buddhist life is really about, which is far different than what I would call the samadhi focus. The samadhi focus has a particular relevance if you are monastic or if you're a monk, if you have indispensable time to do retreats and to sharpen your mind and the power of that samadhi, and that there's enormous amount of interest that can come from seeing at a layer of magnitude that we don't have access to in our normal life, to be able to see like at 600 power microscope. And it really takes us beyond the world that we know and the way we fundamentally describe our world into the world of the small and the subtle. And there is an accompanying array of very alluring states of mind that also move with us when we go in that direction. And those states of mind, if I take you all and for your first introduction to meditation, put you into a 3-month retreat or even a 10-day retreat, and out when you come out of that, you're going to be have a very different idea of your mind than when you went in, and you would be enthralled, most of you, by what you saw, and you would quite likely be hooked upon the retreat mentality for more of that kind of scene and more of that sustained interest. So that's the samadhi focus. But what we're doing here is not the samadhi focus. We have to have a certain threshold of samadhi, certain threshold of being able to focus and sustain our attention. But and starting up, you know, it's harder to start up when you don't have that threshold that's immediately available to somebody who does prolonged retreating. And so there's a lot of people who start up and then leave, and then they have to start up again and then they leave. And after a number of times, they start up and the engine starts working a little bit and they really get hummed into the whole approach to the their domestic life, to their worldly life as a journey of awakening. But it's a little harder to start up. So that's one difference that I have noticed. Another difference is that you aren't hooked upon the subtle aspects of mind, which is a good thing, because you don't have access to them. You have access to your normal everyday mind. So what do you get interested in? The retreat person, he gets interested in the subtlety of the allure of the enticement of the beautiful aspects of mind which accompany someone on retreat. What do we, you and I, who don't do prolonged retreat, what do we get interested in? We get interested in the fact, over time, that our pain, our contraction, is self-inflicted. And when we are no longer willing to accuse others or devoid ourselves responsibility, and we begin to actually take be accountable for that pain, we get enormously interested in why it is and how it is that we're doing that to ourselves. That's the tie-in. That's the key. So this series is the groundwork for that interest. Take these talks and start looking. That's what the homework is. It's to energize our interest into the looking of how it is that we keep creating the enormous amount of conflict and struggle that our lives contain. And become interested. You can't help but become interested when you see that it's self-inflicted. Because the heart, the one thing the heart cannot tolerate is that struggle. It has to find and decipher the codes of its own suffering. That's its overwhelming need, because it realizes in order to meet life, it has to get through the code of that struggle and to see the truth that lies through the understanding of how that struggle is formed. And once life begins to touch life through understanding, then the heart awakens. And when the heart awakens, it just comes out with a force and a momentum that is passionate, is full of life and vitality, full of interest, not just tied to itself anymore, but becomes immeasurably tied to all things, to all beings. And this really is the way of the urban Buddhist. And I'll have much, much more to say about that as we go on in this particular series, which will last most of this year. But we're starting at the fundamentals here, and it's very important for us to get these fundamentals down. Because if we don't, as we build upon the fundamentals, then obviously we're going to be building upon a shaky foundation unless we understand how it is and what it is. And why it is that these the ingredients of pain are a manifestation of our life moment after moment. So we're looking tonight at the desire for non-existence, desire to hide from life, to negate forms, But the spiritual side of that is we're trying to lift ourselves out from the burden of life. We're trying to lift ourselves up out of the burden of life. And we don't know how to do that. We only know how to create and to decimate. That's really what the mind knows. It knows how to eliminate, or it knows how to create. And so using only the mind as our tool, the only thing we can do is to avoid or grasp. Because it's the only thing it knows how to do. It doesn't have the wherewithal. It doesn't have the understanding. Nor does it have the patience for a different approach to living. So, knowing that, but also knowing that the force that's driving the need for us to invest in existence and to divest something and kill it is really heartfelt, mostly. It's heartfelt in the sense that we're trying to unburden ourselves. We're trying to eliminate this struggle that we feel, and we don't know how to do it. So it's confusing, and it's a contortion. It's ignorance, is what the Buddhists call it. And so we have to figure out that that isn't going to work for us, so that we can look at it from a different way. Now, many of us, I have noticed in interviews and other forms of interaction, that we have kind of a pervasive anxiety in us. We wake up in the morning, and there's a kind of way that life has taken on a coating of anxiety. It can be very slight, or it can be very substantial. I've seen it so that people have to take medication. And I also have seen people just have a slight edge to their living situation, where there's just a kind of anxiety, where they're trying to eliminate the undesirable aspects of life, but they don't know how to do that. It's as if they're carrying those undesirable aspects in the very view of how they hold life itself. And we've long since lost the connection to where that anxiety arose, or even why it's arose. We're just trying, and it drives us. It drives us in a way. It creates a kind of tension in our life that makes it somewhat undesirable to even be alive. We want to escape. We want to get out of it. We don't know how to get out of it. And we feel small in our ability to live. We feel diminished in our vitality. And one of the reasons I think that we pull for the little guy in the movies, the downtrodden, is because that quite likely is how we feel in our very interfacing with the world and with our own life. And so one of the ways that this desire for non-existence can take a form within us is this sense of being undervalued in our life, the sense of life being a kind of burden. And in some ways, from time to time, we look out from that burden and we really try to find any meaning, and there's very little meaning there except to try to unburden ourselves. Just to try to survive becomes the meaning of why we live. And then there are also times in everyone's life when the desire for non-existence takes a different form. That's when we wish we could die because of the particular situation that's unfolding that we're in. The embarrassing moment where you just are completely exposed. And believe it or not, up until about more than half my life, speaking in front of crowds was the most I would rather have died. And if it weren't for having to do it in different classes and, you know, just being forced by circumstances to be in front of people, I wouldn't be in front of you today, believe me. In fact, when we look at the list of the three most feared incidences in our life, public speaking is number one. Death is number three. So you get a sense of how people loathe this. You know, this is because there's exposure. It's just, you're just raw. Everybody's just looking at you, and you have nothing to go on but your words or your, I don't know. And so you might ask, what turned it around for me? Well, I think two things. One is that you just do it over time enough and you lose the fear. But perhaps more importantly, and how you lose the fear in this tradition, is that you don't care whether you're exposed or not. I don't care. I mean, what you think of me, it doesn't, everybody wants to be liked, but it's not a matter of life or death to me, whether you like me or not. And to divest from the need for you to sustain me as a human being allows the freedom to be able to do what I want to do when I want to do it and not have it fear-based. And that's for all of us as well. So that incidents where we wished we could die, the desire for existence is so strong that I just wish to die. And sometimes I remember as a young boy having to give a book report or something in front of the class and going home for lunch or something, and then before the afternoon session when I have to give the book report, coming down with some kind of cramp in my abdominal area, psychosomatic, that would keep me at home sick so I wouldn't have to go in. That's how my mind was so afraid that it was going to create illness rather than have to get in front of a crowd. And the power of this desire for non-existence can be tremendously, even more than just making yourself ill. I had a hospice patient one time who was, you know, when you walk into a hospice patient's home, you get a pretty good sense after a few years in hospice care whether the patient, how long the patient's going to be around. You get a good sense. And my judgment with this person when I walked in was that he would be around for a number of months. He was as mobile and as functional as anyone in the room. But then when we also in hospice care are upfront about the prognosis, and we have them sign a consent form that says that they understand the prognosis. And when we got to that point, something changed in him. And he said, I'm not sure that I've heard this as clearly as it's being stated to me right now, that I'm going to die in 6 months or less. And I said, what has your doctor told you? And he said, well, he's been a little vague. And I said, well, he was very clear with us, and I would want you to talk to him so that he's very clear with you. And the man said, no, I believe you. And he then, you could feel the energy. It was as if he just decided in that moment that he wasn't going to waste everybody's time with the dying process. He was just going to die. He was going to devoid himself of existence. And he died within 3 days. He just went to bed. And he just died. I had never seen anything like it in all the years that I was. But I knew it because I was there when he decided to will himself to death. And I saw the enormous power that we have over life and death. There are many times when I saw just the opposite, when people willed themselves to stay alive long after their body should have shut down and died. And so that desire to invest existence in the divine, and the willingness to divest your life force is something that we should not at all take as a minor or insignificant power that we have. It's huge. So another way that this particular desire for non-existence manifests is escaping into drugs and alcohol, losing ourselves, inebriating ourselves so that we'll lose ourselves, so that we won't be available to be alive to ourselves. Because we feel we're beyond redemption, really. And sadly, we feel the only way to really redeem ourselves is to lose ourselves. And so people can choose that form of non-existence. So we're just touching upon some of the ways that we, that the mind uses the desire for non-existence in its normal, it's when it divests from its own life force, when it feels that there's something inherently wrong with it, or that it feels like if it ever relaxed with it, that it would be out of control, that there would be this, in psychoanalytical terms, the id would come forward. And this id is some, in psychoanalytic theory, I never quite understood. It was like this monster, this animal thing that was in you, just ready to plunge, to be brutal and rape, and you know. And then you have this super ego that you need in order to sort of keep the id contained and keep it under control. And so we have all these shoulds and ideals and musts and all of that. Parental discipline to keep the id contained so that it won't become this monstrous. And we sometimes look at our emotions and we feel this kind of out of bounds energy that could leap forth and, you know, consume the world. And so we feel like we have to keep it reeled in, keep the reins of the horse very tightly controlled. And all that internal fighting, all that internal struggle, you don't want this part of you to exist, we have to keep this under control. I mean, all that self-hatred. And that's the healthy human being. As Freud said, a healthy human being is the normal neurotic. Well, I don't consider that healthy. I don't consider that kind of struggle healthy. So it's just no wonder there's this feeling inside of us that we should have never been born, that many of us carry, that we're a mistake in life, that we're a walking mistake. And if anyone looked at us deeply enough and saw into us, they would see the mistake itself. No wonder we have fear of intimacy. Because intimacy is sharing that vulnerability. And if I open to you and you see the mistake I am, you'll cut your love off for me, and that's all I've got. So I'll keep myself distanced from your gaze or pretentious to your gaze so that you can't see the mistake I am. And therefore I can survive with you loving the pretentious me rather than the authentic me. And fear of intimacy is as rampant in this culture as the fear of belief in our own inadequacy, because they go side by side. Now, how long are we going to keep ourselves safely contained in relationship? how long is it before we begin to look at the problem there? Begin to own the problem there. A friend of mine said at one point in his life he wanted to jump off a balcony or a bridge. He just wanted to kill himself. And as we were speaking, he was speaking from the aversion of such an act. And I was, given how you feel about yourself and the pain that you feel about yourself, jumping off the bridge and killing yourself is actually an act of self-compassion, of tenderness. Because nobody wants to feel that way about themselves. But the fact is that you don't have to feel that way. There is another way besides jumping off the bridge. But to even be able to see that's really a heart's response to wanting to end suffering, not knowing how to do it. And wishing part of ourselves into non-existence, right? The fear of being what we are. To escape, to flee. You know, as I was raised in the 1960s with the hippie movement, there was a genuine movement back then towards a spontaneity, towards a radical reevaluation of the themes of our parental themes. And I think that uprising, that was almost cosmic uprising of the youth culture against the themes of established behavior, the themes of traditional goodness and exploring the limits of our life, had in its heart of hearts the desire to be free. But it got caught in the same patterns. It just made a pattern out of its radicalism. Instead of dressing this way, it dressed that way. Instead of saying this, it said that. Instead of eating this, it ate that. And so spirituality can be a reaction. You know, we can dress the part, we can act the part. And in so doing, we find ourselves right back in the same egoic fix, containment, from which we were reacting. There is no spiritual form. There is no spiritual way to be. There is no right, correct spiritual activity for one. Not even service work. The heart has its own way. Each of our hearts has its own way. Each of our hearts manifests in its own way, in its own authentic way. And for some astronomy or microbiology is their way through their connection with life. For others, it is service. For others, it is the heart that feels the pain of others. But to be pretentious or to move in this direction prior to feeling that in ourselves has no basis in. You're not promoting yourself spiritually. You're not going faster on your path. In fact, you're going backwards. So that fear of wanting to be protected by being spiritual. Please don't look too closely at my spiritual form, because I can't even look there. And Many of us have a basic fear of being alive itself, of what aliveness means. We want to contain it somehow. We want to make sure that it's safe to be alive, that it isn't going to get out of hand, that our aliveness isn't going to get out of hand. And so we have a kind of timidity, timidness to our own life, to our own vitality. In old books of Don Juan and Carlos Castaneda, Don Juan was the wise Indian, Mexican Indian. Don Juan says to Carlos, "We don't have time, Carlos. We don't have time to be timid. That is the misfortune of human beings. Focus your attention on the link between you and your death without remorse or sadness. Focus your attention on the fact that you don't have time and let that fact act accordingly. Let each of your acts be your last battle on earth. Only under those conditions will your acts have their rightful power. Otherwise, your acts will be those of a timid person." And Carlos says, "Is it so terrible to be a timid person?" And Don Juan says, "No, it isn't if you're going to be immortal. But if you're going to die, there is no time to be timid, because timidity is fear of life. It soothes you while everything is at a lull until the awesome, mysterious world opens its mouth for you. Then you will realize your sure ways were not sure at all. Being timid prevents us from being fully human." And yet, fully human, the radical uncovering of ourselves, the full-blown existence of ourselves, scares us perhaps even more than death does. We may be more afraid of our power than our unworthiness. And so we try to smother ourselves, try to modulate ourselves with the fear of being fully human, the fear of speaking up or standing out or being an oddball. You see, those are all fears of our own empowerment, because we all are oddballs. It's called unique, being unique. But what if people say, what if... I don't want to, you know, I want to only, I like the word unique, but I'm afraid it'll mean odd. So I'll keep myself kind of muffled. But Ajahn Buddhadasa, his effect on me grows as the years pass. I kind of thought he was minor when I was with him, but he had a major impact. He was absolutely uncompromising. I used to think he's the most uncompromising man I had ever met, because he never did anything. He couldn't be persuaded or manipulated at all. People would come to him and want to give him money, and he'd tell them to throw their money off a cliff. They'd want to build him something, and build a big Buddha statue, and he'd say, "Bow to that rock if you want to bow to something." It wasn't rudeness. It was unmuffled aliveness. You know, at one point, somebody asked him, and in those years, Thailand was always afraid of being taken over by the neighboring countries and becoming communistic. And somebody said, "What do we do?" You know, they were having some communist infighting in some of the back country, and there's some fear of Thailand falling under communist rule. And so the people came to him and said, what do we do? What will we do if we become communist? And Ajahn Boo said, we can practice if we're communist. And then those people went back up to Bangkok and declared that Ajahn Buddhadasa was a communist. that being a communist, he was proselytizing communism. Which your voice wasn't saying that at all. Nothing stops us. Nothing stops this aliveness. Nothing does. And in this room, with each other, we don't have to smother. We don't have to muffle ourselves. We can see the farthest reaches of our own acclaim. We can begin to release our need to not be peculiar and odd. And we do that through the loss of timidity. And that's how we find our way to being authentic, is we test the waters of that. It doesn't mean to be insensitive. I'm not suggesting insensitivity. I'm suggesting the release of our awareness from any bounding whatsoever. Awareness by its very nature is sensitive. It won't step on things, create havoc. It creates intelligence. It creates clarity. It creates seeing. But it won't allow projection to inhibit that seeing, or to contain that seeing, or to limit that seeing. It will go wherever it needs to go. And if we remain timid, if we remain repressed, if we remain dead in ourselves, the desire for non-existence, the desire not to be seen, really, then we lose our passion. And passion's everything. You know, used to limit my passion was that I didn't think I was up to the task of what the world must want from me. I remember as a little kid in Boy Scouts or something, hearing the adult tell me what a good Boy Scout was. And I was so enamored by the qualities that he said, I memorized them. He said, a Boy Scout, and now I'm like 12, right? Is trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful, thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent. Now you're 12 years old. I felt like I was a rascal. Where does rascalness fall in? I always did things. I was like... And so I couldn't approach any of those words. I wasn't up to the task of living any of those words. I was dead in the water. You see? Because we don't make it realistic. And getting in spiritual work can do the same thing to us, can it? We can get so... it can work against us. I don't have enough love. I don't have enough generosity. I don't have enough patience. We're back being a Boy Scout, aren't we? And anyway, who really likes somebody who's loving? They walk all over them. It means being soft and ineffective. That's what we think. So part of us doesn't want it. Part of us doesn't think we could, even if we wanted it, could get it. And part of us doesn't want it. Or contentment means sort of lack of self-motivation, or meditation feels kind of self-indulgent, and you know, you can just keep going. And yet something in us is unstoppable. Something in us is unstoppable. Even with all these words that we, and the meaning that we put on them, there's something in us that knows beyond the word. It doesn't care whether it can meet that word or not. It doesn't care whether it can meet the Boy Scout ideal. So we don't clutter our lives with those kinds of ideals. We go to the aliveness itself, to the vitality, and uncover that. And lo, in the vitality, in the aliveness, we see all the words that we heard, all the patience, all the love, all the contentment is in the robust, in the manifest. And we don't get sidetracked with words and keep putting ourselves on a continuum of where we are in relationship to this word. Because we kill our existence in doing so. We deprive ourselves of the life that we need to live. And remembering that the whole of the Buddha Dharma is to stop infusing something that has no existence with existence. And those words have no existence. Existence has existence. That's it. We go there or we go nowhere. So we seek out our aliveness, what makes us come alive. And we see what it is that inhibits that aliveness is that we keep desiring existence where there isn't any. And we keep depleting life from the existence that is. And we begin to see that. And we stop doing it. We simply stop doing it. It's not a big thing. Angels and archangels don't come down. That's it. I'm not going to do that anymore. You know what that's called? It's called awakening. And it's within each one of your reach if we stop killing that which is alive within us. And may we all do that. Can we sit for a minute or two? Feeling. As we sit, life run through our veins. And not sidetracked, being sidetracked by thoughts, which is the depletion, which is the muffling, which is the containment of that aliveness. So if there are any questions or comments about anything, I'd be happy to do the best I can. We don't have a lot of time for questions because we have quite an extensive announcements, but just with one or two. Yes. Right. Yes, it is. And he's talking about the releasing yourself from what it is that inhibits you, and giving up things, letting go of things, and at some point it becomes a little disturbing as you look at your life from what you have given up, and it feels somewhat different than how it was when it was fully in its drama component. That mind that gets a little bit hesitant there, that's the mind of timidity. That's the mind that wants assurance that it's going in the right direction. And if you can embody, feel for a moment, not the loss of what you have given up, but the aliveness of what you have obtained, because often you will feel very much that, you'll feel that aliveness. You'll feel an increased sense of vitality, a loss of a burden, sort of a freedom of movement that you might not have had before, of an expression in yourself that may have been contained or limited, or just a sense of a wakefulness itself. And we too often go back and rechannel our old energies into predictability rather than seeing the advantage and the benefits and rest, because those benefits, we can't guarantee that they're going to last, so there's a little bit of fear, and they're not really directed towards anything specific. They're just about us becoming alive. And that doesn't seem quite as secure as the old predictable life of drama, or as meaningful, because we haven't learned how to see life meaningfully from just being alive. We want predictable and productive uses from that aliveness in order to make our mind, our life meaningful. So we just have to be careful that we don't sidetrack ourselves. We don't keep putting on mufflers where we're missing the real beauty of what is actually happening, because we want, you know, we're looking for some specific way that that beauty is going to manifest, and it may not be manifesting in that way. Yes. Yes, what it looks like. Yes, you see, what does it look like? That's what muffles it. I'm not at all trying to play games with you, but the need to know what it looks like is the security of the muffle. Is how it holds itself in abeyance, how it stays contained, and that's, you see, you have to free yourself from the need to know what it looks like. And we're afraid it's going to look awful. Me out of control is what the closest thing we could get is, well, 3 years ago I got so angry I threw a bottle at my husband. That's what it looks like when it doesn't look like that at all. But that's where our mind goes. It goes to what we think of when we lost any sense of containment. When the muffler was no longer there, I threw the bottle at him. And therefore, I'm not going to be without my superego. My id will come. You know. So we want to know what it looks like. And so, but there aren't any, what's beautiful, you know, there are no marks. That, because all the marks, all we see when we see another person is what we project that person from our own marks. So somebody who's markless isn't known to us. That's why there's so much pretension in the spiritual journey, because they want you to see them as you project a saint would look. So then they get all composed or serene or grow beards or I don't know what you want, but they'll fit your model. But it's markless. It's without marks. But to the person, to that aliveness, Thank you for this evening.